The following audio is from the weekly message at Summit Church in the upstate of South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
Mark chapter 13, if you have a Bible, I invite you to go there with me, Mark chapter 13. Man, it's good to be together. It's good to be back. I know it's been a few weeks, but isn't it good to be back in this place together? Just really thankful for the opportunity to be with you and to worship together. It's good to be back in the Gospel of Mark. Now, I need to have a conversation with those who plan the teaching calendar, because I have to teach all of Mark 13. And those who plan the teaching calendar is the guy who is teaching Mark 13. I want to pose a couple questions for you to think about. So this is between you and the Lord. I want to invite you into a moment to be honest about where you are and how you're thinking. A couple questions of introspection. Here's the first one. On a scale of 1 to 10, how anxious are you about the future? How anxious are you about your future? One being, you kind of have zero fear, if there is such a thing, little worry, little anxiety about the future. 10 being, you can hardly make it throughout a week without some sense of panic and paranoia about how things are going to turn out. How anxious are you about the future? Number two, if Jesus were to return before this service ended, does that thought leave you feeling anxious, or does it leave you filled with great joy? If he were to return at this moment, the future, the present, how are they connected? I want you to hold on to these thoughts, because we're going to come back to them throughout the morning together. Mark chapter 13, we arrive at likely the most challenging, not just the most challenging passage in the Gospel of Mark, but it is one of the most highly debated passages of Scripture in all of the Bible. It's challenging to read. It's challenging to parse out all that Jesus is saying. It's challenging to know specifically what does this text mean for you and me today, right? And to add on top of all of that, historically, there are many opinions about how do we interpret Mark chapter 13. So before we dive into the text, I want to give three caveats that I think are really important for what we're going to talk about today. Here's the first one. When it comes to difficult passages to interpret and understand, like Mark 13, arrogance and dogmatism has zero place within the church. Zero. Like the pursuit of God and knowledge of God, it should lead us to humility and love, not arrogance and pride. So that's number one. Number two, when it comes to difficult passages like Mark 13, two people can love Jesus, love his church, and arrive at different conclusions about what Mark 13 means. Now, that's not true of every passage, okay? Because there are passages that are critical to the orthodox belief of Christians. The distinction of belief in Mark 13 in no way has any bearing on our salvation. It has no bearing on core theological truths. So as always, I'm going to attempt to be faithful to the biblical text this morning. But when we get to the end, you might go, I don't know if I believe that. I don't know if I was taught that. And that's okay. Caveat number three, and the most important, I want us to be really, really clear on what we do and must agree upon as believers, okay? There are at least four truths that are historically universal for all Orthodox believers, and here they are. The return, the second coming of Jesus Christ. It is imminent. He is coming visibly on the last day. Jesus is coming again. We must agree on that. Number two, and when he comes, he will bring the ultimate destruction of sin, evil, and death. There is a day coming, church, when death will die, sin will be eradicated, and Satan will be destroyed. Number three, there will be a new heavens and a new earth. Every single tear will be wiped away, and all things will be made new. Everything sad will become untrue. And number four, everyone who has placed their faith and trust in Jesus Christ will be raised bodily on the last day. Their spirit, their soul, and their body will be reunited. There will be a glorified body on that day, on that great day, without any hint of sin and brokenness. Those are the things that we must agree upon. And we do agree upon as followers of Jesus. Now, there's a lot going on in this text. We're going to take 2 weeks to look at it. So I'm going to have to move this morning pretty steadily, a steady pace. And I'm going to tell you at the outset where we're going so you can track with me as we go there. There's four major sections in the first 23 verses of Mark 13. And I want to give them to you. I want you to hold on with me, okay? We're going to have to dig a little bit historically in the historical biblical text to understand what I think Jesus is saying here. Here are the four sections this morning. Number one, Jesus does something and says something that is absolutely earth-shattering to the disciples. He's going to do something. He's going to say something. Number two, critical to understanding this passage is verse 4. There's a question that Jesus is asked by his disciples. And this question is what Jesus is going to answer throughout the entirety of this passage. Now, he's not going to answer them in great detail, but he is going to answer their question. That question's critical. Number three, don't be alarmed by birth pains. Now, he's not talking to women who are getting ready to give birth. This is an analogy, and we're going to look at the implications of that analogy. Number four, the abomination of desolation. And some of you are like, what in the world? Those are the four sections. Let's go together. First section, verse 1. And he, as he came out of the temple, Jesus leaving the temple is really significant. Significant to this degree, this is not just a moment where Jesus is simply walking out of a building like you and I are going to walk out of this building in just a few moments. No, this is a definitive moment where Jesus is abandoning the old system of sacrificial worship that had been corrupted over the years. So he does something here. He walks out of the temple as the definitive marker of judgment, impending judgment that's coming. You go, well, how do you know this, Terry? Let's keep reading. One of his disciples said to him, look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings. And Jesus said to him, do you see these great buildings? There will not be here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. And as he sat on the Mount of Olives, opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately. So Jesus says something shocking. He does something shocking in the verse 1. He walks out. And then he says something here that would have been earth-shattering. And he says, not one single stone will be left on top of the other. Again, it's a declaration of the impending judgment of God against the temple that's coming. And it's coming through the person of Jesus. What Jesus is declaring here is that the presence of God and the power of God, it will no longer reside in a physical building. And that building where the presence did reside, that building that was once the centerpiece of Israel's relationship and identity with God, It will be completely destroyed. And God will usher in a brand new way to experience and enjoy the presence of God. Now, let me just pause here for a moment. I think that is really challenging for you and I to grab hold of. And there's a couple reasons. One is we're thousands of years removed from this moment. So it's kind of tough to go, how significant is this? I think the second reason is because we don't tend to put a lot of stock in buildings. Now, I'm not saying we don't put stock into buildings. We of all people know what it looks like for a season to lose our building. But we don't put stock in buildings to the degree that the people of God experienced and relied upon. The temple was everything to them. It's the center of life. Their spiritual identity and national identity was attached to it. And so for Peter and James and John and Andrew, what Jesus is doing and what Jesus is saying would have rocked them to their core. That's what I want us to try to grab hold of. If you're a first century Jew, here's what you believed. You believed that the temple would not be destroyed until the end of the world. So in their minds, when they see Jesus leaving the temple and they see Jesus going, it'll be completely destroyed. In their minds, this is it. It's everything they've ever known, everything they've ever believed in, everything they've given themselves to. Jesus says, you won't even be able to recognize it because not one stone will be left in place. So what do? They ask an obvious question, which moves us to the second section, verse 4. Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished? Do you think that's a fair question? I do. Hey, guys, I'm going to destroy it. When are you going to destroy it? And please help us know what the sign will be when you're about to do it so we can be prepared. I think that's a fair question. And the reason why I think it's critical to the often myriad of interpretations of this passage is because Jesus is going to a degree, answer their question in this text. In fact, what we are getting ready to read, what I will submit to you, is that most of Mark 13 is about the events from 33 AD as Jesus is raised from the dead and ascends into heaven to the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD. Which was a massive, monumental shift in how God is going to now relate to his people and all of humanity. Okay, third section, verse 5, birth pains. Jesus began to say to them, answering their question, see that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name saying, I am he. And they will lead many astray. And when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is not yet. He says, for nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. These are but the beginning of the birth pains. So as he begins to describe what this will look like, the beginning of birth pains, he gives them the very first warning in this passage. Hey, don't be deceived. Don't be deceived. Many are going to be deceived. Don't let your heart and mind be deceived. When you hear of these things, when you hear of war and the rumor of war and natural disasters, can you imagine if they had social media? When you hear of these things, don't think this is God. Don't think that this is the end of the world. No, this is life in a broken and fallen world. These events are not a signal to the end. They are actually the beginning of birth pains. Jesus uses this analogy. It's a beautiful analogy that goes back to Old Testament prophecy and what they Old Testament prophets would often use to describe God bringing about something new. There'll be pain for a season. There'll be hardship for a moment. But that hardship will not last forever. It is giving way to what? Something that will be new. Something that's going to bring forth life. Let's keep reading. Verse 9. There's a slight shift in the birth pains from suffering to persecution. But be on your guard. We get the second warning. Be on your guard, for they will deliver you over to councils, and you're going to be beaten in synagogues, and you'll stand before governors and kings for my sake to bear witness before them. And the gospel must first be proclaimed to all nations, and when they bring you to trial and deliver you over, do not be anxious beforehand what you're going to say, but say whatever is given you in that hour, for it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. Brother is going to deliver brother over to death, and father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death. Verse 13, you're going to be hated by all. And he tells them why, for my name's sake. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. So first warning, Peter, James, Andrew, John. First warning is, don't be deceived. Second warning, be on your guard. You're going to be singled out because of me. Your faith in me, the road that you will walk because you walk in my way, is going to put you in the pathway of displeasure and difficulty from others. But don't be anxious, which is remarkable that Jesus would say that. You're going to be delivered over to councils and governors, and you're going to be beaten. But don't be fearful. Why? Because you have the Holy Spirit. He's going to be with you. He's going to guide you, and he's even going to give you the words to say. Now, I think verse 10, as we think about the implications of what does this text mean for us, I think verse 10 trips up a lot of people. When we think about the return of Jesus, does this have implications of just the past, or is this a forward-looking implication to the future of maybe when Jesus will return? Verse 10 says, and the gospel must be proclaimed to all nations. A lot of times this verse is interpreted as, well, we must be busy about proclaiming the gospel to all the nations so the birth pains can begin to hurry up and happen. And I don't think that's what Jesus is saying. Here's why. I'm going to give you a reason why. Let me read to you the parallel text, Matthew's gospel, the synoptic gospel, same teaching of the Olivet Discourse. I want you to listen to Mark 13, verse 10 from Matthew's point of view. Matthew 24, verse 14. He says, in this gospel, the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world. Throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Well, the word whole world in the first century most typically referred to the known Roman world. That word whole world in ancient literature, in the ancient world more specifically, never referred to a global perspective. So these guys would have heard all nations and the whole world to refer to all those within the regions of the known Roman world. I'll give you one example. Luke 2:1, we read it every Christmas season. It says, in those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. Well, Caesar's not giving a global decree for everyone to be taxed across the global spectrum of the world. He's given a decree to the known Roman people. So here's my point. After the resurrection of Jesus, And before the temple will be destroyed, 30-ish AD, 70 AD, the gospel will be proclaimed to the known Roman world and to all the Gentile nations that are living at this time. They're going to hear the testimony of Jesus. And you know what? It happened. It happened. So before we move to the fourth section, here's what I want to summarize just briefly. Because we're moving at a swift pace. The key markers that God says, hey, I'm going to let you in on when the birth pains are beginning are these. There's five of them. Spiritual deception, global conflict, natural disasters, persecution of believers, and family betrayal. Every one of these, all five of these, will be prevalent until Jesus Christ returns. All of them. You and I live in a world that is groaning underneath its brokenness. So think with me presently about the moment that you and I currently live in, spiritual deception. Do you know that every generation will have people who claim that they have the corner market on spirituality? Do you know that every generation will have people who claim that they know the way to life and freedom? And you and I, now living in a post-Christian society, believe that we don't even need God for that. The way to life and freedom is you. It's individualism. It's your truth, my truth. And we're rewriting the notion on who defines identity, who defines meaning, who defines worth. Did you know that every generation will have people who deny that daily mundane faithfulness and walking with Jesus is the pathway to true life and true joy? And what does Jesus say? Don't be deceived by them. Don't watch their YouTube clips. Get off of their Instagram stories. Stop listening to their podcast. Stop thinking it just because there's a seeming awakening of people deconstructing their faith because they found a new way to life and freedom is now a new and better way. Don't be deceived. Listen to my words. Global conflict. Oh my goodness. Have we not been in the midst of global conflict heightened to a degree over the last 3 years? Natural disasters. The persecution of believers. Not just us, not just folks in the West, but if we were to actually peer into the reality on a global scale, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people that name the name of Jesus persecuted on a day-to-day basis because of their faith in Him. And then the awful reality of family turning against family. There's always going to be these realities. However, between 33 AD and 70 AD, these five things were not only present, they were heightened. Heightened. Peter, James, John, and Andrew experienced all of these things in their lifetime. So think about that. Everything that Jesus tells them to expect, they experienced in their lifetime. In fact, you can go read the book of Acts. The book of Acts describes in great detail what the early church endured that Jesus describes here in Mark 13. I think about Peter and Paul being arrested. Remember what happened to Peter and Paul? Arrested, beaten, brought before kings. And what did they have to do? They had to proclaim. Why? And what? The testimony of Jesus. I think about Christians being persecuted and even killed all throughout the book of Acts. All throughout this book, we see famines and earthquakes and false Christ seeking to lead God's people astray. And Jesus is saying, oh, don't get lost in the fray. There's two things. Don't be deceived. Don't be deceived. Be on your guard. Be on your guard. You see, the issue for the disciples that are asking Jesus this question in Mark 13 is not, Jesus, give us a sign so we know when to predict the end of the world. Jesus, give us a sign so we'll know how to endure presently when suffering comes. That's the issue. And so now Jesus is, he's going to clue them in on when they can know the birth pains are over, and we move to the fourth section. You guys tracking with me? Look at verse 14, the abomination of desolation. Which is just, isn't that just a great name? I feel like that should be the name of a band. It probably is a name of a band somewhere. There's actually a really bad movie out about the abomination of desolation. Don't watch it. But when you see the abomination of desolation standing where he ought not be, and then we're given this parentheses, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Jerusalem flee to the mountains. That phrase, abomination of desolation, it literally reads, the abomination that causes desolation. So abomination, desolation, it's an idea, again, rooted in Old Testament prophecy, and it's the idea of hatred and disgust and idolatry. It's profaning the name of Yahweh. And Mark here, in a sense, is inserting the phrase of let the reader understand. I think it's a marker to let us in on that Jesus is now quoting from Old Testament prophecy. So, hey, listen in. Be sure we're on the same page. Listen in closely. Listen to what I'm getting ready to say. Jesus is quoting from the book of Daniel. If you go to the book of Daniel, there's three distinct sections in the book of Daniel that details the abomination of desolation. And there's two important things I think are crucial to this text and this moment that you and I need to understand about what Daniel prophesies in terms of the abomination of desolation. Number one, what Daniel prophesies about the abomination of desolation took place first in 168 BC. In 168 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes desecrated the temple of God by sacrificing a pig on the altar of God and then erecting an altar to Zeus, a pagan god, on that very altar. So if you were alive in 168 BC, do you know what you would have witnessed? Do you know what you would have witnessed? The abomination of desolation. It was a purely wicked and detestable act against God. We know from history that Antiochus Epiphanes, after this moment, he outlaws Judaism and the temple. You know what? It becomes desolate. Sacrifices are made no more. Now, all of this is before the incarnation of Jesus. So what's Jesus doing here? He's keying his disciples in on something they would have known from Daniel's prophecy. That just as the temple was destroyed in 168 BC, the way you will know that the birth pains are over, the way you will know that the temple is about to be destroyed, is that another abomination of desolation is going to occur. It will be the sign that you need to get out of Jerusalem, and you need to get out of Jerusalem fast. When you see it, it'll be shocking, it'll be devastating, which leads to the second thing we need to understand about Daniel's prophecy, and it is this: there's a second fulfillment to the abomination of desolation that Jesus is describing here. And in the days leading up to 70 AD, there's a man named Titus that comes into Jerusalem with the armies of Rome, and they begin to lay siege to Jerusalem, and they desecrate the temple of God. They were making pagan sacrifices and creating standards that forced allegiances to false gods. I want you to read with me how Jesus describes what this moment will be like. Again, Jesus is taking an Old Testament prophecy of a second fulfillment and still previewing of what's to come post-resurrection. Guys, with me? Look at verse 15. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down, nor enter his house to take anything out. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas for women who were pregnant and for those who were nursing infants in those days. Pray. Pray that it might not happen in winter. Why? Because it'll be impossible to cross. The rivers rise in winter and the conditions will be almost unbearable. So pray. Pray that it doesn't happen in winter. For in those days there will be such tribulation as has not been from the beginning of the creation that God created until now and never will be. And if the Lord had not cut short the days, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, whom he chose, he shortened the days. And then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or look, there he is, don't believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform signs and wonders. Why? To lead people astray, if possible, the elect. And then we're given the third warning, which is a repeat of the second. Be on guard. But he gives a caveat to this warning. Be on guard because I've told you all of these things beforehand. In other words, be on your guard because I've told you everything you need to know. I don't have time, but I at least want to attempt to let you in on the events of 70 AD are incredibly horrific. Like devastating. In fact, we have history paints a vivid portrait of the devastation. Historian Josephus describes much of this in detail, of what was going on when this actually occurred. Thieves and murderers were controlling the city. It was complete anarchy. And one single event, 12,000 nobles were tortured and killed. They burned the food supplies. They poisoned the water. Children were sold as a means to buy food. And eventually, cannibalism became the only means to survive. History records that the Romans crucified about 500 people a day outside the walls of Jerusalem. And at the end of the siege, everyone was either killed or sold into slavery. And conservative estimates predict that 100,000 people were sold into slavery and 1.1 million people died. I mean, it's devastating. And Jesus, in this room with four friends, is keying them on how severe and devastating that moment will be by using Old Testament language they would have understood. I want to give you one Old Testament rendering of this, and I want you to jot down the reference and go back and read it later, but this is from Joel, the prophet Joel, chapter 2. I want you to listen to what he says. Blow a trumpet in Zion. Sound an alarm on my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. It's near. It's a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness. Like blackness, there is spread among upon the mountains, a great and powerful people. Their like has never been before, nor will be again after them through all the years of all generations. Do you see the similarity of what Jesus is quoting here? Here's the point. When Jesus speaks of the great tribulation in Mark chapter 13, he's not saying there'll never be another tribulation. Jesus is not saying that there will never be dark days or dark seasons to come. What he is saying to these four guys is, in Old Testament language they would have understood, he's telling them what to expect when the great day of devastation and judgment is coming upon Jerusalem. Now, what are we to do with all of this? What I'd like to do is just take a few moments and connect some application for you and me that I think would be universally true to the guys in this room. They're asking Jesus this question, the things that he's saying. What would apply to them that would also be true for you and me? And what I believe Mark records here in the 13th chapter from the eyewitness account of Peter, who was in that room for these disciples, that is also true for you and me, is I believe these words of Jesus to his disciples are intended to inspire present faithfulness. Present faithfulness. Hear me very clearly. Jesus is not giving these guys clues on how to predict their future. It's not what he's saying. He is giving them promises to inspire faithful endurance regardless of what the future may hold. Don't be deceived. Be on your guard. And he says it again, be on your guard. Here's Jesus looking his disciples in the eye, and he's telling them, you don't have to be filled with angst and fear about the future, your future, the future of my kingdom. And don't miss this. The reason he can tell them to not be afraid, to not be filled with angst and worry, the reason is rooted in him, not them. The reason he can tell them that is predicated on who he is and what he is going to do. The call for you and I to endure is rooted in the context of the grace of Jesus Christ, the mercy of Jesus Christ, and the abiding presence of Jesus by the Spirit. Gosh, there's devastation all over this text, and Jesus' posture is remarkable. Don't be afraid. Don't be swayed. Don't let the cultural trends weaken your faith. Hey, don't be caught off guard in a post-Christian context. Listen to my voice. Hear my words. If you're here this morning, and you belong to Jesus Christ, if you've placed your hope and trust in Jesus by faith alone, through grace alone, in Christ alone, I want to give you really briefly two reasons from this text that you have no reason to fear the present or the future. Number one, he is in complete control. And I don't say that as like the song we sing, he's got the whole world in his hands. He does. But I want you to know, he's in complete control. Everything Jesus tells his disciples to expect, it took place exactly as Jesus said it would. Like, why do you think they're eager to know the sign of destruction, the sign of the destruction of Jerusalem? Because they knew that what God promised through the prophet Daniel more than 600 years before the coming of the Messiah had taken place as God said it would. So that when Jesus shows up on the scene and he begins to direct their attention to the promises of God, in their mind, it's as good as done. Man, one of the things that I think should anchor our faith in these days is that our faith is historically rooted in the past. It's historically verifiable. Our faith in Jesus Christ, the person and work of Jesus, it is an historical, verifiable fact. And so as you and I, we look back throughout history, when we trace history, what do we see? We see those five things, right? We see spiritual deception. We see global conflict. We see the upheaval of political tyranny. We see family betrayal. We see persecution of believers. We see all of that. But we see more specifically that everything God said would happen, happened. Because he's in control. So as now we look towards the future that we cannot see with the natural eye, what do we know? Well, because God's been faithful from the very beginning, he'll be faithful to the very end. Why? Because our God is in control. And what I want to submit to you this morning is that should deepen our faith in him and give us perspective on our present and our future. And it should lessen angst. There should be less worry. There should be less freaking out. Some of us need to get off of social media. Some of you need to stop watching CNN or whatever outlet that you watch. We need to stop freaking out and trying to, on one hand, take the cultural events of the day and overlay them with the biblical text and know our God has been faithful from day one. He will be faithful to the very end, and what he says will happen, will happen. Nothing will destroy God's kingdom. Therefore, brothers and sisters in Christ, dearly beloved child, nothing can separate you from the love of Jesus. Nothing. Number two, he's not only in complete control, but he's with us. And I don't want you to dismiss that as easily as it is to go, yeah, I know he's with us. Difficult days and dark seasons are inevitable. But here's the beauty of our hope. You and I will never walk through a single day or a single season alone. Ever. He tells them when they deliver you to the councils and you're beaten in the synagogues and you stand before governors, don't be anxious. Man. How, Terry? Because you have the Spirit. You're not alone. I'm with you. One of the things I think is remarkable about this passage is that Jesus loves his disciples enough to tell them the truth. Like here he is in a room. Friends, it's a private conversation. They're asking him an honest question. Here's what Jesus doesn't do. He doesn't give them false hope about the journey ahead. Like Jesus isn't trying to manipulate or ignore the reality that they live in a fallen and broken world. Jesus isn't selling empty promises and a guarantee of riches on this side of eternity. Jesus doesn't say, hey, they're all going to love you because you follow me. Like, you're going to be popular when you walk the halls of your school. And in your workplace, man, they're gonna clap because you're faithful to... No, actually quite the opposite. They're going to hate you. You go, what? You know, another way not to read this text as New Testament believers living in this century, another way not to read this text is to go, well, I'm going to measure the degree of my faith based on the degree of my persecution. That's what we often do. Well, here's what's true. If you decide to walk out of these doors today and this week and to live out your faith, here's what I want you to know. You're going to be dismissed. People are going to belittle you. It may not be to your face. It may be subtle. But they're going to belittle you. They're going to try to suppress your voice. They're going to demean your convictions. And it's not just going to be the world. It's going to come from your own family. I could take the next 30 minutes to detail for you how the attempt, imperfect attempt, but the attempt nonetheless for Tris and I to lead our family in the ways of Jesus, how it has caused a divide within my own family dynamics. It's devastating and real. What I know to be true is right now in this room, all across it, there's pain. And there's hardship. And there's uncertainty. And I'm thankful. Jesus doesn't sugarcoat what it means to follow him. I'm thankful that he tells us the truth, because if we think that Jesus is simply here to make our life better on earth, when adversity comes, here's what we think. We think Jesus has abandoned us. No. The ending of the final warning is this: be on your guard. Why? I've already told you these things. So even when you feel like you're alone, you know what? You're not alone. Even when you feel like there is no way forward, he's working. I want to invite the worship team back up, and we're going to have some space to think about what this means for us right now. To follow Jesus is to experience at some level over the course of your life the displeasure of people and the pain and hardship of a broken and fallen world. I believe the good news of Jesus is this, though. There's a way in following him. There's a way in trusting in his good and wise sovereign control. There's a way in resting in his abiding presence that makes the suffering that we endure worth it. Because it's not the end. It's not the end. Here's what I want you to know. If you belong to Jesus this morning, then you have everything you need to walk in hope, to walk in joy, to walk in great faith, not fearful of your present or your future. But I want to say this to close. If you don't have a relationship with Jesus Christ this morning, like if you don't know him, if the Spirit of the living God has not regenerated your heart and you have not given your life to him by faith, then I want to say with love and humility, there is a day coming. There is a day coming when Jesus will consummate his kingdom, and when he comes, he will once and for all judge sin and every wicked effect of that sin, and he'll judge all those who have rejected him. So if you don't know Jesus rising from Mark 13, I think is an implication, or rather an invitation for you. Now is the time to entrust your life to Jesus. To entrust your life to his grace that will transform you. To entrust your life to his sovereign hand that will guide you. And to entrust your life to his ever-abiding presence that will never leave you. Man, if you feel like the Spirit of God speaking to you this morning and you don't know him, we would love to talk with you, pray with you, and invite you in on how you too can experience a God who is in complete control of everything and who's with you everywhere you go. Would you pray with me, Father? I'm thankful that your purposes and plans cannot be changed or thwarted in any way by the devices of the enemy. I'm thankful for the truth of the conversation, Jesus, that you had with these guys in this upper room. That I believe speaks directly to us in this room. Some very profound things about how we can endure presently in this moment, despite what we're walking through, despite what the future may hold. So Spirit of God, would you take your truth and would you apply it to our hearts that, God, we can live from a posture of believing that you're not just in control of our future destiny, you're in control of the very thing right now that's got us consumed, that we don't think we can make it past today. And you're with us. You're out in front of us, you're with us. You're enabling us, you're empowering us, you're helping us, you're sustaining us, you're guiding us. What a beautiful and profound hope. And Spirit of God, I pray that you would illuminate it to our hearts this morning. Man, I don't know if you need prayer. We've got some of our prayer team here, and I'm just going to invite them to go stand in the back. If you're here and you need prayer this morning, if you would be honest enough to just admit that, and one of the ways you can admit that is by having the courage to maybe stand up and just walk to the back to allow one of our team members to pray for you, to pray over you. Go feel the freedom to pray for one another. If you don't know Jesus, perhaps even moving even to one of us in the room to go, I want to know him. Spirit of God, speak and move.
Thank you for joining for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child the repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. We'd love to connect with you, so we invite you to reach out to us at summitupstate.org.